Welcome to a very special edition of EncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. EncLive On Air is a podcast from EncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, EncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Debu Tripathi, MD, to discuss recent therapeutic additions to the HER2-positive breast cancer armamentarium. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Tripathi, professor and chairman of the Department of Breast Medical Oncology in the Division of Cancer Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, discussed the state of treatment in metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer, current sequencing strategies, and targeted agents under evaluation in this setting. So to start, could you discuss what the current landscape looks like and how the many recent approvals have impacted the treatment algorithm?
The landscape for HER2-positive breast cancer is somewhat complicated and very fluid. Just in the last half year, we've had the approval of two new drugs. And the key issue here is a biological one. HER2 is truly a driver. There are certain cancers that are driven by genetic abnormalities that result in protein characteristics such as the expression of the HER2 receptor in this case that continue to be an important driver even as the tumor may evolve through different stages of resistance. And so we have found that really every single treatment we use in HER2-positive breast cancer upon serial progression is targeting HER2. That still remains a viable target. It's just a matter of targeting it in a different manner, in a different way. So really, those are the two new therapies that have been approved. One is a antibody drug conjugate, which targets HER2 just on the basis of HER2 being expressed. The toxic moiety is actually a chemotherapy drug. It's not specific to HER2. And then the other one is a kinase inhibitor that does specifically inhibit the HER2 kinase domain. In fact, it's the only HER2-specific kinase inhibitors. The other ones also inhibit the epidermal growth factor receptor. And these have, in fact, yielded significant and notable differences, particularly in refractory-resistant breast cancer, which is why there's so much enthusiasm about these new drugs, and there's many more in the pipeline.
So starting with the antibody drug conjugates, how have they really impacted the landscape? And could trastuzumab deruxtecan potentially replace T-DM1, or is there a role for both agents in the metastatic setting?
I don't think we necessarily know the answer to whether one is replaceable by the other. There are certain characteristics of trastuzumab deruxtecan that are distinct from T-DM1. One of the principal ones, at least in the laboratory and preclinical models, is that deruxtecan is water-soluble. And so when that antibody drug conjugate is internalized into the tumor cell, it is slowly released into the microenvironment and can diffuse back out of the cells, and it may be able to impact other neighboring cells. And this is important because we know that HER2 isn't uniformly expressed on all tumor cells, that there may be some that are expressing more HER2 than the lower ones. We sometimes even see that when people become resistant, that the resistant subclone that grows up has now lost HER2. And because trastuzumab deruxtecan can bind to lower expressing HER2 cells, you know, HER2 1 plus and 2 plus, it may have an advantage over T-DM1. So I think that for the most part, we will see that when patients progress on T-DM1 and then they do receive trastuzumab deruxtecan, that we're probably not going to go back to T-DM1. Now, in terms of safety issues, though, there are some concerns about trastuzumab deruxtecan and interstitial lung disease and some GI toxicities. Of course, T-DM1 has its toxicities, too. You tend to see neuropathy and sometimes liver function test abnormalities, thrombocytopenia. So they each have distinct toxicities, but that may also guide treatment paradigms. Now, there are going to be trials that move trastuzumab deruxtecan further up into lines of therapy, head-to-head comparisons against T-DM1 and things like that. So I think we'll ultimately get a better sense as to how to use these drugs.
So then currently, how does sequencing stand?
For HER2-positive patients who either are presenting with de novo metastatic disease or have in the past received trastuzumab in the adjuvant or neoadjuvant setting, but it's been more than a year. So for those patients, the first-line therapy has not changed. It is typically a taxane, most commonly docetaxel, but some people use paclitaxel with trastuzumab and pertuzumab. So that is still our standard first-line therapy. Second-line therapy is also relatively standard, and we're still using TDM1 on the basis of the Amelia study and the Teresa study that has showed a superiority over lapatinib and capecitabine, which used to be one of the second line therapies we've used before. So the first and second line therapies still haven't changed. Now the second line therapy may change. They're in the second line trials going on now, looking at alternate therapies other than TDM1. The third line is a little bit open right now. There are two drugs that can be used in that setting, in part depending on what the patients have received previously. But both the HER2CLIMB study, so the tucatinib, trastuzumab, and capecitabine combination can be used in the third line setting, and so can trastuzumab drugs, TCAN. I think right now the sequence in which one would use it would be based on a couple of things that the clinician may consider. One is the level of evidence. You know, with the tucatinib has a higher level of evidence. It was a phase 3 randomized trial that showed a survival difference. So I think for the most part, that's going to carry the day. Whereas trastuzumab deruxtecan, the phase 3 data is still awaiting. And the phase 2 data is notable for the fact that patients were heavily pretreated. And so this may be an option to save for later. And then the final issue is the toxicity. Even though it's very rare, the problems with interstitial lung disease that can be fatal, of course, is something to factor in as well. And also the presence of CNS disease might pivot you a little bit more towards tucatinib, because it did demonstrate activity in the brain, which makes sense because tucatinib is a small molecule inhibitor, and as well as capecitabine, the CNS levels may be a little bit higher. That's how we sort of make clinical judgments in terms of which of these drugs we might use in the third line setting. And of course, whatever you don't use in the third line setting can be used in the fourth line setting. And it's not uncommon at all for our patients to have very good performance statuses on later lines of therapy.
So then, pending an FDA approval for margetuximab, where do you imagine that agent will be integrated?
That's hard to say. Margetuximab is a very interesting drug in theory and the way it was designed. The whole idea of being engineered to better augment and better interact with the immune system is something that has been thought of for a long time. It's been over a decade now that we've recognized that the immune system plays an important role in the response of HER2-positive breast cancers, especially when using antibodies. The antibodies that are approved are IgG1 that have the ability to engage T cells and effector cells. And so the binding of the Fc portion of the antibody to these effector cells can be variable because people inherit different versions of the receptors. And so the fact that this is engineered for that Fc portion to bind more tightly to immune components really has been demonstrated in preclinical models. The big question is, how does this translate to clinically? Well, what is the human immune system actually seeing, and how well is it reacting? And what the SOFIA study showed is that it does seem to be making a difference. The clinical difference is not that great in terms of additional months of PFS and survival, but it is important. So I think it is going to have a role in later lines of therapy. I think it's a good drug to have. I think that some of the ongoing studies may pinpoint patients who might benefit more than others, and so that would be good to know. And I think that continuing to refine this whole concept in terms of the bispecificity of antibodies is an important area. There are other bispecific antibodies that engage the immune system that are being tested right now. And so I think that this whole field is ripe for advances. But I clearly think that there will be a role perhaps in later lines of therapy.
So, of course, we're seeing more data specific to patients with brain metastases. Is there any rationale to exploring genomically guided therapy for those patients?
Yes, I think that genomically guided therapy can be used for any patient, whether there's brain metastases or not. The word genomically directed therapy is a broad term. I think there's many ways you can interpret that. One, for example, is when you're targeting a specific mutation. And one of the more common mutations that we see in HER2-positive breast cancer that's druggable right now is PIK3CA mutations. About 25% of HER2-positive cancers do harbor this mutation, a little bit higher in the hormone receptor-positive ones. And there are trials going on now combining PI3 kinase inhibitors with trastuzumab or trastuzumab pertuzumab. For example, in the maintenance phase after induction therapy for first-line therapy, there's a large study going on now with two drugs, alpelisib and copanlisib. So, you know, we're going to learn more about genomically targeted therapies. There are other genomic lesions too. First of all, targeting the HER2 amplicon itself at the DNA level or at steps down downstream from that is important, and some other escape mechanisms. For hormone receptor positive, there may be additional mutations that can be targeted, such as cyclin D amplification. We know that CDK inhibitors now have shown improvements when combined with HER2-targeted therapy. So that's another area that is ripe for exploration. And so, yes, I do believe that as we learn more about the genomic landscape of HER2, we will find better drugs. It's clear that under selective pressure, you do get additional mutations. Even the RAS pathway can now exhibit mutations, particularly in patients who are on hormone therapy that have HER2-positive and hormone receptor-positive disease. So we are going to see more of that. These are going to be very niche trials. These are going to be rare populations of patients. They're going to require that we really collaborate on a national and global level to be able to enroll to these types of studies.
Are we seeing any sort of developments specifically for patients with leptomeningeal disease?
Yes, leptomeningeal disease remains a very difficult disease to treat. And there are, especially in HER2-positive disease, some interesting trials. The one that is open now as part of a consortium trial through the Breast Cancer Consortium, the TBCRC, is one with tucatinib, along with trastuzumab and capecitabine. So essentially the same regimen that was tested in HER2CLIMB. There is some data of activity, of course, from the larger randomized trial in the CNS, and even a little bit of pilot data in a few patients that had leptomeningeal disease. So that is an ongoing study. And then we have other approved drugs that are specifically for patients with brain metastases that we sometimes use in LMD with people that have progressed, say, after whole brain radiation and aren't amenable to stereotactic treatment or just any type of surgery. So, for example, the combination of neratinib and capecitabine is one that is active and is actually listed on the NCCN as treatment just for CNS disease in general, but can be used for leptomeningeal disease.
What are some emerging agents that are under investigation that we should be keeping our eye out for? I know you mentioned bispecifics earlier.
Yes, there are several drugs that come to mind. There is a bispecific antibody, ZW25, that binds HER2, and then the other part of the antibody, it activates two different epitopes on HER2, but it's one that is showing activity in heavily pretreated patients. It's still in early phase testing, and that one is interesting. There are several other immunoconjugates that are also being tested that bind different epitopes that use different payloads. Some of them have some unique toxicities like ocular toxicities and other toxicities like that. That's something about that we have to be mindful of. There are some other kinase inhibitors like pirotinib, which is a drug that's been developed primarily in China, and they've shown some activity as well in randomized trials. Although I think how it's going to compare to catnip, for example, still remains to be seen.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives in cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.